name's Rob Argent, and I teach patent law at Boston University Law School. I don't have any slides, and I don't have my bottle with me, but I will start you out with a joke. Thanks. And then we bring more to life. It's actually a joke about sort of the patent culture, and I hope to say a few things about this. What it's like and what it's becoming. Our panelists today give the line of the joke, but I'll let loose with it anyway. I ran into this friend of mine who's a patent lawyer, and I said, Hal, you look very happy today. And he said, yes, I am. I went shopping yesterday. I said, why are you so particularly happy? And he said to me, well, I bought two suits, a blue one and a brown one. I said, that's nice. He said, but I'm really happy about it. And I said, why? He said, because now I have four new outfits. Maybe it takes more.
It's obvious.
Anyway, here's the point. Here's the point. It's been a kind of an isolated community for a long time. And only really in the last 10 or 12 years has patent bar or patent system received a great deal of increased attention from the public at large. Part of it is the dollar figures have started to really be significant. As a famous congressman once said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. Another reason, I think, is the general sense that technology and inventiveness are important economic policy questions, issues, so we need to start paying more attention. I'm going to get back to that point. Let's start by going backwards and hopefully give a sense of where I think this increased public attention is leading and what the patent system is going to look like down the road, at least what some of the interesting questions are like. In the beginning, patents had to do with privileges granted by government. It's important to keep it in mind because the fundamental function of the patent system has really changed over time. As I identify in my paper, copies of which are available for those of you who find this stuff interesting and who didn't get the joke, the first reference I found to what looks like a patent system was really a proposal by Hippodamus discussed in Aristotle's Politics. Hippodamus says we ought to reward people who come up with new ideas. Probably not surprisingly, Aristotle was quite critical of this for all kinds of interesting reasons. Essentially, I would ascribe them to the essentially conservative, communal-oriented outlook that most of the classic philosophers had. But anyway, the idea was out there a long time ago. The next time that the patent system really emerges, as you look along the historical timeline, was during the late medieval period, early Renaissance in Italy, some of the Italian city-states. I think it's fairly obvious that at this point you're still talking about a privilege from the government granted to an inventor for a particular invention. It's not what we would call a patent system. The interesting thing is, though, that for the first time we do see patent grants being made to individuals, characteristic of, I think, general enlightenment sense that individual people are important and make a difference. Contrast that with Aristotle's response to Hippodamus. We don't want to rock the boat, because things aren't so good. Maybe this patent idea is not so hot. The next time we see reference to patents in any significant number, putting aside the Venetian case, the important Venetian case, is early industrial revolution period in Great Britain. At this time, patents were still essentially privileges granted by the government. That is to say, it was more or less a case-by-case appeal by an inventor to Parliament. Hey, I need special protection. There was somewhat of a system in place because of an outcry over royal prerogatives, royal privileges, which had led in part to the British Civil War. Or the Commonwealth period, it's all prior to the First Restoration. But the point is that it was really a special privilege granted by the Parliament. And really, if you if you look at the patent system, proto-system, really, it had more to do with what we would today call trade policy than rewarding individual inventors in a systematic fashion. Here's what I mean. You could get a patent if you were the first to invent something, and that's similar to today. But you could also get a patent if you were the first to introduce into the realm a new art. This was used as a device to encourage the importation of technologies carried in people's heads and hands, mostly from Italy and the Low Countries. Many of the early patents, we're talking here about late 17th, early 18th century, had to do with skills like glass making, where the Venetian artisans were particularly skilled. These early chemical process technologies and some other sort of highly skilled craft type technologies. Sometime during the 18th century came what I consider a very important shift. And it's the shift from patents as a system of privileges, really, to patents as individual property rights. The conceptualization of the patent system changed from make an appeal to Parliament and get an exclusive privilege to draft a patent application that tells the world about your technology and will give you, an individual, a property right. Basically, the vehicle that carried out this change was the specification. Patent specification is the document you give to the patent office when you make your application that tells the world how you do what you do, why it's different, and why it's new. Gonna run. Dr. Seuss patent system here. But really, the point is that the conceptualization changed from appeal for a special privilege to let's make a deal, really. Parliament says, if you tell the world, which includes, importantly, the other inventors, the inventive community, how you do what you do, we'll give you a patent. The emphasis came to be put on the disclosure that you put in your specification. And the really important, I think, point about that is that you began to get a body of technical knowledge that was freely available to everyone. It was necessary to file one of these specifications in order to get a patent. And that's how you get this pyramiding effect. Only when you have a royally enforced, in the British case, requirement that you file an application and fully describe how you do what you do, do you have a body of knowledge that's open to other inventors. Instead of a trade policy, let's get new arts on the ground, becomes an information policy, dissemination policy, serves the kind of function that an agricultural extension service might serve, university, publications in sciences. That's a fundamental shift because it puts the information that individuals are coming up with out into the public domain. And that emphasis on the relationship between the private individual and the public is one that I touch on in my paper and I think is important in the history of the patent system. And by the time we get to the American case, in the early colonial period, we essentially have a transfer of British conceptions. First patent was granted in Massachusetts just about 350 years ago. That was the special privilege model. The specification idea came to the US a little bit later. The important thing to note about the American situation, though, was during the period of the Articles of Confederation, there was a lot of conflict between individual states who had granted their own patents for the same inventions, the classic case being the steamboat. You had a fellow named John Fitch, you had Robert Fulton, you had several other inventors, all of whom were working on steamboat technology. New Jersey gave a patent to one, New York gave a patent to another. It was impossible to take a ferry boat run by steam power from New Jersey all the way to New York without transferring the middle because there would be infringement as soon as you cross the state line. I don't have to describe the nightmare that we would have if we had 50 different patent systems. The solution with the US Constitution was one unified patent system. The reason I bring this up is I think that to some extent, some of the same impulses are at work now on the larger level of the international scale. We have some of the same problems now fitting patent laws together that we did in the period of the Articles of Confederation fitting state patent laws together. Not all the same problems, globalization hasn't gone that far, and many features, important features of world patent systems overlap, but there is a potential for some of that problem, some of those problems, and that's why I see this push nationalization. It's the same kind of economic logic towards integration that gave us one U.S. patent system. So I thought I would raise that. Apart from the historical discussion, throughout history there has been a series of arguments made that center around the economic effects of patent. And that's something that I'm, in fact, quite interested in, which leads me to my second joke, for those of you who are drifting off. It seems that Mikhail Gorbachev last Mayday was reviewing troops, and here come the squadrons of tanks, here come the planes, here come the infantry. And finally, rounding up the rear of the parade, is a frumpy-looking group of professorial types in overcoats and top hats and air flying out, having an animated discussion. Gorbachev turns to his aide and said, who are those fellows? Who are those people? The aide says, Mikhail Sergeyevich, those are the economists. And Gorbachev says, a minute later, he says, what are the economists doing in the Mayday parade? And the aide looks at him condescendingly and says, Mikhail Sergeyevich, you have no idea how much damage they can do. the reason I raise that is that in the last 10 or 12 years, one of the ways that the patent system has been gaining attention is a renewed interest among economists. What are the impacts of this thing? What happens when we have patents? How does the patent system work? How does it change things, distort things, et cetera? I think there's the potential in this movement for some amount of damage. Basically, in the beginning, it was a simple theory of the patent system. You could really formulate it one of three ways. There's essentially the idea that a patent is an incentive, we'll hold it out as a carrot to inventors. There was the very closely related idea that it was a reward in exchange for disclosure. This is characterized as sort of a contract between the inventor and society. You disclose what you've done, we'll give you a property right in return, kind of a deal. And the third conception, which we owe really to the French Revolution, is the idea that patents are simply the positive government affirmation of pre-existing natural rights. That inventors, when they create something, from the moment that they create, actually have natural rights, you know, rights that precede the existence of the legal system over their inventions. And we, society, in the form of government, come along and simply affirm that right by giving a patent. There are still elements of all three theories that float around. In the U.S. model, the incentive, disclosure theories, as I call them, they're really the dominant ones. In the European systems, they tend to be dominant, but there is this natural rights tradition that's also floating around out there. You can line up commentators on both sides, very well-respected historic figures on both sides in the patent debate. Are these good things or not? You've got Jefferson, Mill, and Bentham in the pro camp. You have a series of fairly well-respected sociologists and some historians in the anti-camp, and a lot of 19th century economists took that view also. To some extent, the debate hasn't changed all that much. If you construct a kind of theoretical conceptual model, you might come up with reasons why patents are good. Construct a different model, you might come up with reasons why patents are horribly dangerous and essentially anti-competitive. Well, an enterprising historian about 15 years ago decided to test the thesis by doing an interesting case study. He said, look, these conceptual arguments are nice, but I want to get some data. I'm going to study European countries that repealed their patent laws for extensive periods in the 19th century. What effect did that have on those economies, specifically the Netherlands and Switzerland? And unfortunately for those of us who would be a nice, clean answer, he came up with a rather ambiguous answer. To some extent, he concluded, there wasn't a significant reduction in GNP growth in Switzerland and the Netherlands during the period when they had repealed the patent laws. On the other hand, he concluded there was a certain amount of distortion. The economy essentially adapted to the fact that there weren't patents, and the industrial landscape looked different than it might have if the patent system had existed. Now, some people have argued that this is a difficult case because these are two countries without patent systems in the middle of a continent full of countries that do have patent systems. So to some extent, these two countries, the companies in those countries, sort of used an adaptive approach. For instance, the Swiss pharmaceutical industry really took root at this time. And in the beginning, it was essentially what we might call a pirate industry, piggybacking off the very success of those economies in some sense depended on the existence of patents in other economies. So that didn't work so well. Nevertheless, that study and others like it have been cited increasingly in discussions between the U.S. and developing countries. The typical argument here is, look, the U.S. says, you ought to get a patent system or strengthen your existing system because it's in your own self-interest. And economists construct very elaborate models, stored in site cases like these, and the argument is made that it's in the interest of these countries that ought to go ahead and do it. They respond with a lot of interesting counterexamples, some of which are fairly convincing. Certainly the best point that the developing countries have is that it really depends on the state of development and the kind of technology that the country is good at as to whether or not a full-scale patent system is really a good idea. For instance, developing countries can cite the Japanese model and the Korean model to some extent. Japan has had a patent system since the war, the last war. The Japanese patent system does have some teeth. But the difference is that the Japanese system really kind of rewards much more incremental invention. And to some extent, because of the way the system works, it has been alleged anyway, the Japanese patent system is really not a very highly protected system. It's not a very strong patent system. And Chalmers Johnson, in his book, Media, the Japanese Miracle, stipulates that in his view, this was an important part of the Japanese development strategy. They would be borrowers from technology. They would have a patent system, but not a particularly strong one. And this would be used by them to try to borrow technology from the West until they came up to speed. A similar set of arguments is made about Korea and some of the other developing countries. Certainly, it should be noted that even in the U.S., our patent system didn't take on its current contours until really late in the 19th century. So there's perhaps some argument that we ourselves adopted some kind of unconscious but incremental protection of intellectual property rather than sort of all at once kind of approach. And so the question of do patents work is still floating around and is perhaps not going to go away anytime soon. I would say that there are some encouraging signs, as I indicated at the beginning. I think we can all breathe a little easier because we have a lot of economists working on this problem. So, at least we could say. The bottom line for me, though, is that if patents weren't so important, I just wonder why people would litigate over them and spend money to get them. I can't ever get away from the basic proposition that economists don't know what's valuable. But fortunately, business people don't listen to economists. They keep going out and getting patents and using them. You really can't get away from that fact. There's something about the things that business people think brings some value. And so, although we may not be able to figure it out exactly, I think we have some good ideas, it's pretty clear to me that this is an important component of a society that wants to encourage invention. Discussion that was cited by Professor Lenay at the beginning to the effect that even if it's not important economically, it sort of shows our cultural commitment to innovation. That might be it. There's a lot of other economic points that you could make. Anyhow, I do think they're important, and I think I know that Congress thinks they're important. Now, I think there are two reasons for that. One is good and one is bad. The good reason that Congress thinks they're important is that Congress has decided that competitiveness is an important concern. The health of the U.S. economy is something that Congress takes very seriously these days. I think that's a good thing. The bad reason is that unlike direct subsidies, unlike more graduate fellowships, unlike better funding for the NSF, unlike more engineering centers, patents, at least in the immediate effect on the budget, are perceived by Congress as free. So if you strengthen intellectual property protection, you simultaneously do something nice for the business community, wave your hands over the competitiveness problem, and very importantly, don't spend a dime. You don't spend a dime. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why patent policy, whole emphasis on intellectual property rights has so much currency in Washington. As I said, I think that's a good thing to some extent. It can have some bad effects. Every time you strengthen intellectual property rights, you certainly help an inventor. But as the pyramid shows, you affect, in this cascading way, other people down the line. Strengthening one right, in a sense, takes something away from somebody else, or at least affects the rights of somebody else. As Ed Anders quoted me as saying, in effect, you can picture a world where that gets out of hand. Paraphrasing the famous legal scholar, I could say, in heaven there are no patents, and the lion lies down with the lamb. In hell, there is nothing but patents, and due process is meticulously observed. I think you have the idea. And so I think there are some signs that perhaps the trend can have some negative economic consequences. Let me give you one example. I don't want to go on forever. Sometimes companies go to Congress and say, look, patents are for 17 years, we know that. We've got a special case. For one reason or another, you really ought to extend our patent term. Equities of the situation, the very valuable benefits that we're contributing, some kind of procedural gimmickry in the beginning of our patent term that hurt us. For one reason or another, Congress, please extend our patent. It's possible to get this kind of legislation passed, although traditionally it's been difficult. These are called private patent bills. Now, if Congress has it in its mind that every time they strengthen intellectual property rights, they help the economy, I think we're going to see more private patent bills. I think you can also see why this might not be such a good thing. The reason is, I'll give you one example, a recent pharmaceutical patent was said to be worth on the order of about $1 billion a year in revenue for a particular pharmaceutical company. They were enticed by the prospect of future profits to make an appeal for a private patent bill, an extension of their patent term. They spent lavishly in the lobbying community in Washington, but nowhere near as lavishly as $1 billion. Figures have been floating around, and they spent $10 million, and they spent $20 million. It doesn't matter. The point is, obviously, it was worth it. The economics are there for the firms. They're going to go to Congress and say, would you please extend our patent? The more times Congress says yes, the more times other companies are going to say, hey, that works. What bothers me about that, I think, is fairly obvious. If you conceive of the patent as a deal between society and the inventor, this is a renegotiation of the deal way down the line. Now, this is like upping the rent without signing a new lease. That's something that bothers me a little bit. So I thought I would raise that. Let me talk about three problems for the future very quickly. The next speaker is actually back in law school. There's a problem of patenting animals. Some of you may be aware of it. A compromise proposal is out there to try to accommodate the interests of farmers and inventors. This Congress may have something to say about that. There is a problem of the future direction of the Federal Circuit, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. As the exhibit states, the Federal Circuit has made some important contributions doctrinally in patent law, although some of us haven't liked all of their doctrinal innovations. But certainly, the Federal Circuit has, I think, sincerely tried and has worked in strengthening patent rights. And word is out there in the street, the example of IBM, Texas Instruments, the Polaroid, Kodak, a damage award is certainly something that's going to get the attention of patent lawyers, CEOs. Now, I mapped out the trend in damage awards from the inception of the Federal Circuit, and it goes up significantly. The average damage award is increasing. The new record set by Polaroid is simply one data point on an overall increasing curve. Obviously, then, the patent system is going to be perceived as being of higher value. As I suggested, that's good for inventors, not so good for those of us accused of infringing. And as the pyramid concept shows, many times we're both. And so a simplistic model that says let's reward intellectual property rights is always going to run into that problem, that the reward is also a punishment for other people. How much of a reward, how much of a punishment, these are issues we grapple with, not daily, at least weekly. But the basic point is that it's kind of a simple policy nostrum, I think, can be dangerous. In some ways, it's been a good remedy for the anti-patent bias in the 60s and early 70s. Another area that's important is this area of algorithms. I think it's a good example of trends in scholarship, which try to say, look, instead of looking at the patent system in the aggregate, let's look at the effect of patents on this particular industry. And the computer software field is very interesting because there haven't been patents in that area until very recently. And although there is still a nominal requirement that you tie your software invention to some kind of hardware, Mr. Herbert suggested, that is really getting more and more nominal, which I mean is becoming a simple formal problem that you can easily overcome. There have been patents issued that really, for all intents and purposes, have to do just with software. The problem with that is that the software industry itself is split on this question. A lot of the smaller firms say, we don't need patents, which is an interesting paradox if you buy the incentive theory, right? Because here you have little programmers saying, please don't give me that incentive. I really don't want it. Don't give me patents. Please don't reward me like that. The interesting problem is some of the bigger firms, IBM, primarily in digital, feel the other way about it. They feel that patents are important, especially because of growing international competition. Just a historical note, in every area where patents have been proposed, in every new technology where patent extension has been proposed, there's always been people who say, this will damage the industry, this is no good. It certainly happened in the chemical field in the early 20th century, late 19th century, and it didn't really happen. So there is that historical thing to keep in mind. One thing, though, to keep in mind on the other side of the argument is that this pyramid of blocking patents is going to take on Tower of Babel proportions, potentially, in the software field, because many small elements of programs will be patented. And I've heard general counsel from WordPerfect say that there are as many as 1,000, 1,500, maybe 5,000 patentable concepts floating around in WordPerfect 5.1, raising the interesting problem of how we can possibly negotiate and keep track of royalties on all those components. We only have two examples from history. One is a very complicated aircraft patent pool, which is essentially forced on the industry by the government during World War I. And we have the automobile industry, which had a successful patent pool for a long time. Those are private arrangements that resolve this network of blocking patents in some very interesting ways. The difference is it's on a bigger scale in the algorithm industry, and the algorithm industry isn't an oligopoly the way those industries were. There are many more players, so the transactions are going to be even more complicated. One proposal that I've been thinking about is a kind of blanket license agency like ASCAP for copyrights, where programmers contribute their patents, and then you take a blanket license, depending on the kind of software you want to work with. It's a rough idea, but it's basically centered around the same problem, which is how do we break through this knot of entitlements in a private ordering way? Because the patent system really encourages those private deals. I don't know how that would work. Let me say one thing about international protection to wrap up. That is, as I mentioned, the U.S. was originally 50 patent system, not 50 at the time, more like 15, but it was a group of state patent systems that integrated. As I suggested, I think this is going to have to happen to some extent on the world scene. The problem with this is it's even harder to get countries to cede sovereignty over anything. If you take a look at EC deliberations, you see what I mean, than it is to get states to give up sovereignty. And the problem becomes this. Unless you can get harmony not only in the formalities of patents, applying for them, having them issued, getting them granted, but also at the level of doctrine, the level of rules that the courts follow to decide cases, there's always going to be an unevenness of coverage that I think is going to lead to sort of friction in the international community. I'm not proposing a world patent court, although I think it will be a nice thing. I'm simply saying that the integration problem is going to be greater at the international stage. Finally, I'd just like to close by saying that I highly recommend the exhibit if you haven't seen it already. It's really excellent. And for somebody who teaches a lot of the cases featured in the hallway, I found it very useful and very interesting. And I highly commend the Cooper Union for putting on this whole thing. Thanks.